Let's turn to Titus, the epistle of Paul the Apostle to Titus, and look at some leadership in the church today. An important passage here that we want to consider today. And I'm just going to read the verses that we'll be looking at. We've covered the greeting, the introduction of the letter that Paul writes to Titus. I want to read verses 5 through 9. That's our text for today. This is why I left you in Crete, so that you might put what remained into order and appoint elders in every town as I directed you. If anyone is above reproach, the husband of one wife and his children are believers and not open to the charge of debauchery or insubordination. For an overseer, as God's steward, must be above reproach. He must not be arrogant or quick-tempered or a drunkard or violent or greedy for gain, but hospitable, a lover of good, self-controlled, upright, holy, and disciplined. He must hold firmly to the trustworthy word as taught, so that he may be able to give instruction in sound doctrine and also to rebuke those who contradict it. I want to just read a couple of notes from study Bibles here that are, I think, are helpful. The Reformation Study Bible reads this way: Paul moves into the body of the letter. His intention is to instruct Titus regarding how to act as Paul's representative on Crete. He begins by discussing church organization. And then if you look in your bulletin, we have an excellent note from the MacArthur Study Bible. I thought you should follow along with me, so I put it in the bulletin so you could do that. God's standards for all believers are high. His requirement for church leaders is to set that standard and model it. Such leaders are not qualified on the basis of natural ability, intelligence, or education, but on the basis of moral and spiritual character and the ability to teach with skill as the Spirit sovereignly has equipped them. And let's look at a passage. Before we go into the text here, turn to 1 Peter chapter 5, where you'll find the Apostle Peter saying some of the same things that Paul's going to write here to Titus. And this is 1 Peter 5, beginning of that chapter. So I exhort the elders among you as a fellow elder and a witness of the sufferings of Christ, as well as a partaker in the glory that is going to be revealed. Shepherd the flock of God that is among you, exercising oversight, not under compulsion, but willingly, as God would have you. Not for shameful gain, but eagerly, not domineering over those in your charge, but particularly, listen to this, but being examples to the flock. And I think we should note here that these characteristics that we're going to look at, that Peter mentioned some things there and we're going to look at, are qualities all Christians should endeavor to put forth, not just the elders of the church. There's something here then for all of us, how as we seek to live our lives in such a way that we can be, as Jesus said, the salt of the earth and the light of the world. Now, we can ask this question: how did Paul and Titus come to have ministry on the island of Crete, which is a rather large island in the Mediterranean Sea? I didn't check any of the statistics of it, but it's a pretty large body of land there. We don't know how they came to have ministry there. Now, Paul had at least almost had some contact with Crete on the trip that he was forced to take from Caesarea to Rome as a prisoner. So would you turn to Acts chapter 27, where we have some mention in a passage here about the island of Crete and some cities on it. Paul's on a ship. He's being taken to Rome. And I'm just going to pick it up here in verse 7. This is Acts 27, verse 7. We sailed slowly for a number of days and arrived with difficulty off Cnidus, and as the wind did not allow us to go farther, we sailed under the lee of Crete, off Salmone. Coasting along it with difficulty, we came to a place called Fair Havens, near which was the city of Lasea. Of course, this is Luke writing this about Paul being taken on that journey. And if you'd read on, so we have mentioned here of two cities on Crete, Fair Havens, Lasea, and there's one other mentioned if you read on, and it's called Phoenix. But it doesn't seem as if Paul had opportunity to get off of the ship, and so we have no indication that Paul did any preaching to people at that time, that he met any Christians here. And here's another question we might ask: how did there come to be Christians on this island? What do we contribute the start of the church to here? Not Paul, he's not the father of the church. And frankly, we don't know, but let me offer a suggestion to you. If we're still in Acts, turn to Acts chapter 2, where we read of the people who were present on that day of Pentecost. On the day of Pentecost, of course, you know that the unusual thing that happened was that the Holy Spirit came upon a group of Jewish people who were gathered there, and some of them spoke in tongues. And the really significant thing is that this led to them all listening to Peter's preaching. So I want to just begin here in Acts 2, verse 5. Now there were dwelling in Jerusalem Jews, devout men from every nation under heaven. And at this sound the multitude came together. And they were bewildered, because each one was hearing them speaking in his own language. And they were amazed and astonished, saying, "Are not all these who are speaking Galileans? And how is it that we hear each of us in his own native language, Parthians and Medes and Elamites and residents of Mesopotamia, Judea and Cappadocia, Pontus and Asia, Phrygia and Pamphylia, Egypt and the parts of Libya belonging to Cyrene, and visitors from Rome, both Jews and proselytes, next word, Cretans and Arabians? We hear them telling in our own tongues the mighty works of God." It could be that this is how the church began on the island of Crete, that these persons, as they listened to Peter preach, they heard the gospel, they were convicted in their hearts. It says 3,000 souls were saved that day, and it may be some of those were from Crete, and they went back there and took the gospel, and that may be how the church was birthed. Now, that's all somewhat speculation, but it's an interesting possibility. So Paul and Titus must have visited the believers on Crete sometime after Paul's release from his first Roman imprisonment. And just reading at the beginning of verse 5 again, it says, "This is why I left you in Crete, so that you might put what remained into order and appoint elders." So Paul had left, but not before giving Titus oral instructions about the churches, about some things that needed to be done there. And now it seems he's writing those instructions in a letter. And one of the first things is elders must be appointed. As we read on, and so we get to next week, also Titus needs to deal with false teachers that are there. Indeed, there must have been a lot of them. And then he's further going to give instruction about correct doctrine and Christian conduct that should match that correct doctrine. So he says, "It's why I left you in Crete, so that you might put what remained into order and appoint elders in every town as I directed you." Now, we're not told what was the process of appointing those elders either. You almost might think that Titus of himself chose certain men that he thought would be capable for this duty. I would say it's possible that they may have, the congregation may have been involved and elected elders, and they listened to Titus suggesting these qualifications that be found there. Certainly that's how we do it in this church. There are different forms of church government, but congregational government would be the congregation elects officers. So that's the thing, another thing we can't be sure of. Now, there are two words here that we need to look at. They're the word elder and overseer. So here in verse 6, or verse 5, Titus is to appoint elders. Look at verse 7. The word changes, for an overseer is God's steward. Now the words elder and overseer refer to the same person or the same office. The word elder, the Greek word is presbyteros, which one of the possible meanings of presbyteros is an elderly person, elderly male in that particular form of the word. But that doesn't mean that elders have to be old men, like in this church. Roger and I, of course, Randy, he's a spring chicken yet. But it does refer, it's a kind of a title, and it brings forth the idea there should be maturity found in this person who occupies the office of the elder. The overseer has to do with function. The word is episkopos, to see over. To give oversight to the church, to lead. The overseer is to care for the spiritual needs of a congregation, to help people grow in knowledge of doctrine and to avoid the pitfall of false doctrine, to help people stay on course in the midst of the struggles of life, the illnesses they may experience, all kinds of difficulties that arise. And of course, Satan seeks often to take advantage of us in these. Now, here's another question. There's no mention of deacons in this passage. There were no deacons, evidently, in the churches in Crete, at least not at this point. There are qualifications for deacons found in 1 Timothy 3, verses 8 through 13. And also, you're probably aware you find these similar qualifications for an overseer in the first 7 verses of that chapter. I don't know why they didn't have deacons in the churches on the island of Crete, but we don't have deacons either. I think some of this can be rather fluid, and if we ever need deacons, we can appoint them. But right now, our elders do a good job of covering some of the things that they might need elsewhere to cover. So we want to look back on these spiritual qualities that are necessary to serve in this office of the elder over the overseer, and know that these should be the goals of all committed Christians. So let's get started here. Here's the qualifications. If anyone is above reproach. Well, that's a little bit intimidating, I think, to be above reproach. We could try some other word maybe. Hendrickson suggests blameless. That doesn't make it any easier. Somewhere I read in my reading, this person cannot be called to account. And that is intimidating. I find that intimidating. I know that I need to be careful sometimes in things that I say, especially out in the world to people who aren't Christians, and it reminds me I want to be very careful about that. I've always not always been as careful as I should. But that's a kind of a general statement that this elder needs to be above reproach. The second qualification that is listed here is he is to be the husband of one wife. And by the way, I think you'll notice as you read through this, and if you look in Timothy 2, it's all male, the person that's being spoken of is a man. You find like words such as he. So the elder must be the husband of one wife. There's kind of a cross-reference here suggests a man of one woman. There's all kinds of different interpretations of this that have been given by people, and I'm just going to mention a few of them. One might think that this means that the elder can only have one wife. He can't be a polygamist. Now that seems unlikely to me that that's what Paul means, but there may have been that sort of thing on the island of Crete. Pagan people who some did practice polygamy, and when they became Christians, they must realize they cannot practice that. I don't think that's very likely. Another view is that what Paul is indicating here of the elder, that he must be married. He must be the husband of one wife. I think it would be more likely, if that's the way we should take that, it would read the husband of a wife. And look at 1 Corinthians chapter 7, where it would become clear that if this was the requirement that an elder had to be married, Paul would certainly not qualify. Because in 1 Corinthians 7, verse 8, Paul wrote to that church, to the Corinthian church, "To the unmarried and the widows, I say that it is good for them to remain single as I am." Now, very many times, of course, I think elders or overseers are married, but that should not be a requirement. A third way this has been understood is that the elder can only have one wife, and if his wife should die, he cannot remarry and remain an elder. I don't think that's true either. And in 1 Corinthians 7, same chapter, I should have told you just stay there, but if you look at the end of 1 Corinthians 7, verse 39, Paul wrote, "A wife is bound to her husband as long as he lives, but if her husband dies, she is free to be married to whom she wishes, only in the Lord." And I think that might well go for men as well, and also people in the position of an elder. There's some other interpretations too, but I think the one that is most useful is, like they've put in a kind of a cross-reference here, a man of one woman, a one-woman man. It's speaking to the fact that the elder has to have loyalty to one woman only, and that's his wife. I must be faithful to his marriage vows. No adultery must occur. And the issue of marital infidelity has fallen many people, many men in ministry. It's a very sad thing. I don't have the exact quote, but I think Billy Graham said something like this one. He said, "It's not wrong for a man to look at a woman. It's the second and the third look that call things into question." So this person must definitely be true to his wife and is not interested in other women. The next qualification says, "And his children are believers and not open to the charge of debauchery or insubordination." The Legacy Standard Bible, and some of you have been able to get this new, it's a new American Standard translation, and I'm thankful to have one too now. They translate it this way, "having faithful children who are not accused of dissipation or rebelliousness." Not too much similar or different because from what this reads in the ESV. I have a commentary by a Dr. Hebert. He wrote, "An elder's inability to govern his children would place in question his ability to train and govern the church." And let's look over at 1 Timothy 3. You won't have to turn very far to get to 1 Timothy. And this, of course, is the other place where we have requirements for an overseer. Look at verses 4 and 5. "He must manage his own household well, with all dignity, keeping his children submissive. For if someone does not know how to manage his own household, how will he care for God's church?" So that is certainly sensible thinking and correct thinking as well, because the church really is a family. It's a spiritual family. This brings us then, go back to Titus, to now verse 7. Here's where the word changes to overseer, for an overseer. I'm not going to have you turn to it, but there's another passage where the two terms, elder and overseer, are used interchangeably, and it's in Acts 20 where Paul was speaking to some of the elders of Ephesus. He met them at Miletus, and the two terms are used there as well. So for an overseer as God's steward, here it is again, he must be above reproach. Where it uses the term elder, he must be above reproach. Where it uses the term overseer, he must be above reproach. This is a word to look at as an overseer, as God's steward. What is a steward? A steward, the Greek word is oikonomos. It's a combination of two words. Oikos has to do with house, and nomos is a word for law, house law. A steward was a servant set over a master's house to manage it for him and in his place. And overseers to be like a steward managing God's house. Now, this is like Joseph. Joseph, remember, who was sold unto the man Potiphar. And because Potiphar found him to be a very capable person and trustworthy and honest person, he set him over his house. Look at Genesis 39, verse 4. I hadn't really noticed it and this until this week. The word that is used here concerning this appointment. Genesis, I hope? 39, chapter 39, verse 4. So Joseph found favor in his sight, that is, in the sight of Potiphar, and attended him, and he made him overseer of his house and put him in charge of all that he had. I just thought that's interesting. We have the word overseer there too. It's not translating a Greek word. It's translating a Hebrew word, which I don't even know what it looks like. Wouldn't try to pronounce it to you. But it's just interesting that because that is the function that he was performing. He was to manage a household. Let's go back to the text again. He must not be arrogant or quick-tempered. That word arrogant could be translated not self-willed. That's a hard one. We're not to be self-willed. We are to set our will aside to serve the Lord. The elder is to be that way and to lead in that way. And he's not to be quick-tempered. He's not to be a hothead. He's not to be given to outbursts of anger. Patience might be a good word to go with that as well. Patience, by the way, of course, is one of the fruit of the Spirit. And then going on here, I'm going to suggest possibly these next two words might go together. Some of my commentators seem to present it that way. Not a drunkard or violent. I like this translation a little better. Not addicted to wine. I don't remember what the other word was. But I thought we should take a look at this. It's not to be addicted to wine, not to be a heavy drinker. The Greek words, there's really two words here, me paroinon. Me is a negative. It means not. Paroinon is a combination of the preposition para, which can mean beside us, to be beside something, and of oinos, which is a word for wine. Literally, not beside wine. Homer Kent, in his commentary, said, from the original meaning of one who sits long beside his wine, there comes the meaning of one who becomes quarrelsome after drinking. So that might be why you could have those two words together, not addicted to wine and not violent. Now, I want to say something about this. Drinking of wine in moderation, there's nothing wrong with that. And that's okay. Look at Psalm 104. Sometimes I think this needs to be cleared up in the thinking of Christians. It's not the use of wine that the Bible condemns. It's the abuse of wine. And notice this in Psalm 104. I want to read verses 14 and 15 of God. It says, "You cause the grass to grow for the livestock and plants for man to cultivate, that he may bring forth food from the earth, and wine to gladden the heart of man, oil to make his face shine, and bread to strengthen man's heart." The Bible actually speaks favorably of wine. Does this mean, of course, that to be a good Christian, you should drink some wine? Absolutely not. If you don't like it, my wife, Jan, can't stand it. Well, she doesn't need to drink it. But neither should she tell me that I shouldn't have a glass of wine once in a while. So, but certainly here, an overseer better be careful here, not a drunkard or violent. Then it goes on, or greedy for gain. Ministry is not to be a money-making business. Try to tell that to the TBN crowd. They don't believe that. Here's a good cross-reference. Look at 2 Corinthians chapter 2. And if you remember, we studied one chapter in 2 Corinthians. We kind of got into it a little bit, some of what's there, the enemies that Paul had. They're false teachers there. 2 Corinthians 2, verse 17, where he writes, "For we are not like so many peddlers of God's word, but as men of sincerity, as commissioned by God in the sight of God, we speak in Christ." Peddlers of God's word. This word that is translated peddlers here is a word that means a huckster. I read that as one of the commentaries on the Greek use of the Greek word there. Is there anything worse than a religious huckster? And then I don't know why that clock doesn't stop once in a while. It just keeps moving. But let's go on here in verse 8. But hospitable. Hospitable. The word translated hospitable is philoxenon, friend of strangers or lover of strangers. And there was really a great need in the early church for Christians to open their homes to one another, especially traveling evangelists who needed some place to stay. Many of the local places of lodging were not even very safe. And pastor must be hospitable. A lover of good. Homer Kent, again, in his commentary writes, "The overseer should be an ally and an advocate of everything worthwhile." Self-controlled. Upright. This refers to conduct that meets the approval of God. It may be holy. An older writer, Linsky, said, "This is conduct which observes the true and established ordinances of the Lord." And then disciplined. This is an interesting Greek word. Enkrate. A.T. Robertson, writing about that word, I'm quoting now, it says, "Having power over, picture of self-control." Some of these words kind of overlap. There's a number of these words here in Titus that it's the only time they appear in the New Testament. Kent, again, listen to what he wrote about this word in Krate. "It is the usual Greek term for self-control, particularly regarding sensual appetites." So brings in again that idea of moral faithfulness. Verse 9, "He must hold firm to the trustworthy word as taught, so that he may be able to give instruction in sound doctrine and also to rebuke those who contradict it." That brings up the matter of teaching. Look again at 1 Timothy 3, and it is in verse 2. It says, "Able to teach." I do not think all elders necessarily need to be teachers. But that's a good quality to be found. Certainly in a teaching or preaching elder, that must be true. And then also look in verse 6. 1 Timothy 3, verse 6. Where is that? "He must not be a recent convert, or he may become puffed up with conceit and fall into the condemnation of the devil." Good for anybody in a church office, not to be a recent convert. It reminded me of something that happened with me many years ago now when I became a Christian. I don't really know when I became regenerate, but I know where I was when I was baptized, or where I was baptized was at the Second Baptist Church in Boise, Idaho. And I was converted at the same time as another man who became a good friend of mine, George Smith. And this church did something that was absolutely a big mistake. They put George and I on their trustee board immediately. I don't know why they did that. Maybe because George was a lawyer and they thought he could use some of his expertise there. Well, being recent converts and not thinking about what we were doing, George and I had discovered that the Second Baptist Church was a member of the American Baptist Convention, which was a member of the National Council of Churches, which was a member of the World Council of Churches. We discovered there were a lot of liberal American Baptist churches. We didn't think that was good. So George and I think we went to the second meeting of this trustee board and told them we thought that our church needed to withdraw from the American Baptist Convention. By the end of the week, I and my family were out of the church, and so were George and Dolly Smith. It was requested that we leave. And it turned out for our best, really. The next church we went to was an even better evangelical church. This was, by the way, an evangelical church. But I think back on that and think, what a mistake they made. They should not have placed us in those positions. We weren't ready for them, and they weren't ready for us. And so it's just a good thing to remember. Just a couple more things. Look at 1 Timothy 3:1. The saint is trustworthy. If anyone aspires to the office of overseer, he desires a noble task. And think about that. Maybe there's some people here, some person here, some people here who will someday want to be a part of that noble task and become elders in a church. I'm not saying necessarily that means you have to be a pastor, but occupy this position of leadership. Just think about it. There's a few people who could think that way today. And then finally, we hold firmly to this, that we're talking about a man who's got one wife. The whole passage speaks of men. It's not women. Even the pronouns are masculine. Even in the Greek, it's even stronger in the Greeks, the articles that are used. And they're not female, they're male. And I just can't understand. I absolutely can't understand any church that calls women to be pastors. What do they do with this passage here? I cannot fathom it. And some of them are pretty decent churches once in a while, but they do it anyway. But these are good requirements for this particular office in the church. But again, I want to say that these are qualifications for all Christians to consider for themselves too, not that we're all going to be elders or overseers, but that we're to be this kind of a people. This is what the world needs to see. This world needs to see Christian homes. This world needs to see Christian people living like Christian people are called to do. It would make a big change, I think, in the condition of this country. Well, let's stop there. We'll go on with verses 10 through 16. We'll finish chapter 1 next week.